This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 115th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today, Mudge. Hi, Mudge.
Hey, Gary. How you doing?
Mudge, who's really Peter Zatko and best known to me and everyone else as Mudge, is currently working on what he calls the CyberUL project. Mudge has worked at Google as a researcher, at DARPA as a program manager, at the startup At Stake, and at BBN Technologies. But just as important as all that, Mudge was one of the leaders of the Loft Hacker Collective in Cambridge. Mudge received the Office of the Secretary of Defense Exceptional Public Service Award in 2013. He's also a guitar adept and a recovering Suzuki violin player, like me, who has a degree from the prestigious Berklee School of Music. Mudge lives in Boston with his wife, Sarah. Hey, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So I thought we would do this chronologically just because. I think I first crossed paths with you in Ithaca, New York at Suzuki Summer Camp, and I don't even know how old we were at the time. 11?
Yeah, we must have been wee toddlers, because that was part of, what was it called, something like the Young Prodigies?
I don't know. Yeah, it was like...
It was Dr. Suzuki would go around touring, and then all of the parents would drag their 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds. I think you have me by only a couple years, so I'm not sure I was... Yeah, that's a long time ago.
That is a long time ago. I actually toured with Suzuki in 1976,
wow.
Dude.
Wow.
So some years after that, I came up to visit the Loft.
Yeah, we were like, hey, you want to become great hackers? Yeah, cool. Yeah,
that was
see you in 20 years.
That was more like 1996 that I came up there. So tell us about the legendary Loft. So who was it? What was it? Where did it come from? And so on.
So the Loft started out as essentially just a place to store equipment, and it was, I think it started out primarily with Brian Oblivion and Count Zero and their significant others telling them to get their, you know, broken computers and everything out of
the heck out of their
hallways
apartment.
And out of the kitchen sinks, from et cetera. So they rented some a place with some other friends and their wives, and it was really just a little hangout, and more than anything, just a kind of like dumping ground for, you know, errata and tech stuff. And then the wives and significant others were doing this little, almost like Etsy-ish sort of craft thing. And after a while, I mean, some of the folks there knew me. I think it was White Knight and some of the other guys invited me in, so I chipped in and, you know, pay a little bit for the rent. So I had a little spot to unload some of my dumpster stuff as well.
Yeah.
And it didn't take too long before, I mean, it was great to, like, you know, hang out and be with everybody, but I just saw too much potential. So long story short, I kind of was involved in morphing it from just a little hangout group to actually having a drive to become that sort of Rachel Carson slash, you know, pre-crazy Ralph Nader, and kind of like Consumer Reports, sort of like, let's share how things break and how, you know, the technology, because there wasn't anywhere to go to learn about, you know, the strengths and weaknesses in software systems.
Yeah, I was breaking Java with Ed Felton at the time, and you guys were really annoying the heck out of Microsoft, I recall.
Yeah.
But when I came up there in 96, you know, there was lots of stuff. There were people working on projects, you know. There were, what, seven of you at the time?
So 96 was already one, I think that was the second location.
Right, it was.
And it had been going since, you know, 92, 91. And, you know, the first year or two was more of that sort of like club hangout. And then after I got involved, and it wasn't all me. I mean, everybody, you know, liked the vision that I had to try and, you know, make the place self-sustaining and actually kind of give it a mission. So yeah, at that point when you came up and we got to jam around a bit and hang out, we were already on that sort of, we've got hardware, we've got software, we've got communications, we're trying to break everything, we're trying to publish everything we knew.
Yeah.
Because we didn't want other people to have to, struggle to learn how things work the way we did. We wanted other people to say, here's what the Lost guys have published, so now I know that as a foundation. Where, how can I take it further?
Yeah, it was very cool, and it was a lot of fun. Actually, you guys were having more fun than anything else, from what I recall.
Well, that's because you came up and we were just playing music, and that was kind of an off night on a weekend. So
I don't know. I didn't bring my laptop on purpose.
Yeah, less fun to cart the TC2000 massively processing supercomputer up the stairs and take apart the VAX 11780 to make all the wall separators. But yeah,
so
if you're not having fun, why not do, you know, why do it?
So you were also active in this thing called the Cult of the Dead Cow. What was the relationship between the Cult of the Dead Cow and the Loft?
Well, Cult of the Dead Cow, which was this, you know, is this, you know, and I use the word lovingly, ancient hacker group that I remember reading some of their postings, some of them very humorous, some of them actually, you know, with some technical detail. And some of those folks were in the Boston, Cambridge area as well. And we knew each other from the summer cons and the ho-ho cons, some of the older conferences, the ones that predate DEF CON. And at one point, I mean, we were all hanging out, and they said, hey, would you mind donating a technical paper to us to publish, because we've been doing more media hacking and exploration and seeing how, like, that world works, and we haven't done anything on the technical side. So I said, yeah, sure. And I threw them a paper I had done on attacking Belcore's ESCII implementation, which the tool I wrote was called Monkey, monitoring all the keys. And you know, from that point on, I mean, it's just pretty much been in name. But there was an interesting crossover, which was Back Orifice.
Yeah, Back Orifice, yep.
And Back Orifice was a remote administration tool, and it was originally done by Sir Distic out of the Cult of the Dead Cow, and then Dildog at the Loft, a colleague of ours. You met Dil.
Of course.
He did BO2K, you know, the kind of next version, really, like, you know, souped it up. And I stopped and I looked at that and I said, well, this is ridiculous. This is the exact same. It's actually more capable than PC Anywhere, or I don't even remember if Remotely Possible or whatever the names of the other, you know, commercial remote desktops were.
Yeah.
I said, let's put like a professional service pack for like file manipulation, all the stuff that you'd want in a business organization, and release it and see how the media handles it. We'll do it through the CDC because it's got this spin, this bank of evil on it.
And we'll call it
but
Back
in actuality, but in actuality, it was the exact same software as these commercial ones. And it was just amazing to watch. You know, the media and the corporate and the commercial world assume that these one, you know, that the commercial software, which actually was much more vulnerable, and had much, you know, much fewer security controls in it, you know, those were fine, but this other thing, which was not. And that was the dance between the CDC and the Loft. And I used the two to figure out how people would interpret things, what, you know, the initial spin, how final is the initial spin that you put on something that you release, and what's, you know, the functional fixation, you know, using another term from psychology, on something being presented as to its particular uses. And I'd do that through the CDC, and then I'd go back over to the Loft, and I'd kind of, you know, use that as a learning for how we wanted to position the technical papers and the work we were publishing so that it would be most easily consumed without people just discarding it or dismissing it as, oh, evil hackers, but still having a little bit of that fun.
Yeah. So while you were still at the Loft, you guys testified before Congress, and I think you visited my family in our log cabin, too. I don't know if you were in that crowd or not. Did you?
I was indeed, yep.
I thought you were Pillow Island, I seem to recall.
That's right. Pillow Island with your kids.
So do you think that the lawmakers that you were testifying before got it back then? And what about now?
Well, it was an interesting situation because even the other Loft guys really didn't know the details as to how that Senate testimony came about. And it was through relationships that I was starting to build in the government because I was trying to educate decision makers and lawmakers because I needed them educated because they were making really bad decisions.
Yeah, I mean, Marcus was
CFAA
doing the same thing at the White House.
Example. Yeah, CFAA, ECPA, you know, all those which predate this, but I was, you know, an aficionado of, you know, all the way, you know, from their time going into law, pre them being law. And yeah, so I had access to the White House and I had access to other folks, and I would do free teachings or courses to anybody in the government, any organization, as long as they didn't pay me other than travel and lodging, and that I didn't have to talk about anything I didn't want.
You know what? I recall flying you down one time and I had to get your real name, which you were really playing close to the vest so that you could get on the airplane.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that actually worked pretty well. I mean, I held that one close to the vest all the way until the White House actually accidentally leaked it.
Right. well, you needed it to fly after a while, right? Driving down is no problem.
Yeah, but I mean, we drove a lot. I mean, I had a horrific fear of flying. I'm still not that great.
I remember that. Yeah, and I remember the story about going to the cryptographic museum-ish in the van through the wrong entrance.
Yeah, lots of fun stories. We were essentially doing signals intelligence in this Dodge Ram 3500 green 17-passenger van with black tinted out windows and just an antenna farm on the roof. And I took him through a wrong turn into the actual NSA parking lot in teaching the I-4 and C-4 groups there, which became X, which ultimately kind of merged into TAO, which now is in the news a bunch.
You gotta love
That was it took a while for the other loft guys to realize how close we got to being in a lot of trouble, because the security guard there just waved us through without checking any credentials.
Exactly.
And it was like, oh, crap. And they're like, this is great. And I'm like, no, turn around.
No,
leave now. Yeah.
So the lawmakers sort of maybe kind of got it back then, but what about now? I mean, you were more deeply involved in the government later. Are we just doomed because those guys don't even believe in evolution?
Well, yeah. So break. I'll skip the story about how we went there and who got it and who didn't. Here's the big challenge that I see. The U.S. government spends a tremendous amount of money and throws some smart people at the cybersecurity problem. But the smart people that they're putting at it are not in leadership positions.
Right.
I'm not saying they're dumb people, but check this out. You have a cyber czar. I don't care which one you choose, present one all the way back to the first one being Richard Clark, when he was a national coordinator, counterterrorism, critical infrastructure. And you look at their backgrounds, and you say, yes or no, this person should be in charge of, you know, policy or the expert in that field. And none of them had histories of it. None of them had backgrounds. None of them had been in the weeds or had, you know, spent their time, you know, knowing how this works inside and out. Not saying they have to be in the weeds presently.
Yeah, but you should have to pay your dues as a technologist, I think.
Well, you need to for a couple of reasons. One, you need to be able to tell when somebody's pulling the wool over your eyes. And since there's money involved, that happens a lot. And two, you know, you want the person to be able to make informed decisions as to what's actually practical and what the level of effort is to pull it out. Compare how they treat, let's say, the Surgeon General. The Surgeon General does not have a passing knowledge of medicine that they learn on the fly in that position. You know, but however, the current cyber czar can, you know, I'm not picking on the current cyber czar in particular, any of the leaders that they've put in place at a high enough level. It's kind of like, oh, you'll learn cybersecurity. You don't really need to do it to do this job, or you don't really need to understand it.
Which is crazy.
You can't have a chairperson of the Federal Reserve, you know, come in and be like, well, I don't really understand economics, but I'll figure it out as I go along.
Right.
You know, and because they aren't treating those positions with the same importance and realism that they do the other ones, they're dismissing it and saying, this isn't a real field, and you don't really have to know what you're doing there. And then they wonder why they're spending billions of dollars and nothing's, you know, panning out.
Right. Well, I think part of it has to do with not just security, but any aspect of technology, really. I mean, there are very few real scientists in Congress.
Yeah, correct.
It's not a zero number, but it's a really small number.
Yeah, well, and in any of the leadership positions, I mean, that they used to, you know, call General Alexander, you know, a mathematician in cryptanalysis, you know, when he was in the NSA, he wasn't.
Right.
You know, not by the classic stance. I mean, the closest that I've seen is you know, I was very successful in DARPA, not just on the DARPA projects, but the Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon and all sorts of folks would call me in because I didn't have a horse in the game.
Right.
And I was just happy to explain to them ground truth. And if, you know, one agency or one service was claiming capability X and the other one's claiming it Y, and it's largely about a budget sort of thing,
yeah.
I could go in and say, like, all right, well, X, here's what they have in X, because you get the baggage pass in that position, which is great. And here's what's in Y, and here's what's aspirational about it. And then they can make informed decisions.
So the National Academies
are PowerPoints.
The National Academies are supposed to be providing some of that role, too, like the National Academy of Science, National Academy of Engineering. Did you ever cross paths with those guys, or were you, you know, pretty much relegated to DOD stuff?
So, well, I was primarily over on the DOD side because DARPA, you know, is,
of course,
is directly out
it's of under DDR&E.
DOD. Yep, absolutely. And, you know, I was with Brief Ash Carter, you know, frequently, and, you know, all the joint chiefs, you know, Cartwright, et cetera, et cetera. So not so much, definitely some interactions with Defense Science Board and positions there. But there, you know, oftentimes what I see from that, they use those groups as, you know, little panels that they'll convene mm-hmm. quarterly to get a report or something. But what they ended up using me for, which I was just super privileged and honored to do, was they just call up and be like, can you come over and, you know, and walk me through this? You know, because I need to figure out what's real and what's, you know, and what's BS.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, that's a call I'm not going to turn down.
Of course. It sounds like fun.
Yeah. And you know, I wouldn't advertise it because if folks had known that that was going on in the background, you know, at certain levels, you know, the large defense industrial base folks who this was either going to make or break or cost, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars of work for them based upon, you know, would have spent all their time lobbying. But because they had an expert who was working for the court, essentially, you know, as an expert witness that works for the judge rather than for the plaintiff or the defendant, you know, all I cared about was giving them factual, technical information that they could then use for informing their decisions.
So let's switch gears a little bit. The Loft Corps was rolled into At Stake, along with Ted Julian and Dan Gear, in the beginning. And it was this sort of classic startup that was eventually sold to Symantec for a pittance, really. What was the biggest lesson you learned personally from your time at Stake?
Oh, I'm not sure I could actually limit it down to one. Well, let's see. I can't do everything. I nearly cracked trying to, because not only was I running the R&D group of Loft, but then they took IT away from Dan Gear and gave that to me, and then I was doing a lot of their sales and, you know, and their
so
know,
too
PR.
Many hats. Too many hats.
Yeah, way too many hats. And the other part, was that I expected more out of other folks, in a way that very well might not have been realistic, because I was comparing them to the level of effort that I was putting in, not saying other people weren't trying really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But
no, it was your passion.
Yeah, exactly. You know, a lot more tactical moves, a lot less strategic moves, and since I was the only person at the table in the executive room that was fighting for the strategic aspect, you know, I was outgunned and outnumbered.
Right, right. So, some tough lessons, really.
Oh, of course.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. The next big shift was DARPA, which you've been talking about a little bit, where you seem to really have shaken things up a bit. So what was your work at DARPA like, other than the kind of expert witnessy type stuff? You know, as a program manager, what did you do?
Well, the expert witnessy thing was just this nice little perk that once folks, you know, met me and other agencies, you know, made use of. It's strange how I went into DARPA, because I had felt that DARPA had lost its way. And the director prior to Regina Dugan, Tony Tether, had been there an unprecedented amount of time. And I actually think that doesn't work well for agencies.
Wasn't Zan there in between, or was that pre-Zan?
that was post-Zan. Tether was there the entire during the entire Bush administration. So essentially, he was there 8 years.
Got it.
And the average tenure for a director there is about two. Same thing happened with Alexander over in NSA. And mm-hmm. while they have done great things, I think that cycling the leadership and not letting like one outlier be there so long, you know, is very important.
Hmm.
So Regina Dugan came in as the director, and I went in and I said, all right, I think you've lost your way, but I'm willing to, you know, work to the bone to figure out if we can salvage it. What are your thoughts on that? And she's like, here, I'll give you enough rope to hang yourself.
I'm like, that's what
I
wanted.
I believe when I went in there, she's a really impressive woman, but so I was interviewing with her and the deputy director, Ken Gabriel, who's now the CEO and president of Draper Labs.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, at the end of the interview, they're like, well, what would it do to, you know, what could we do to actually, you know, convince you to come here? And I said, you know, an offer letter would probably be a good first step. And they just, you know, it's like I set them up and they just slid it right across the table.
Yeah, great.
You know, right at that moment.
So what project that you were associated with while you were there are you the most proud of doing?
Oh, for the project, well, you know, it's two. A lot of people would immediately say Cyber Fast Track because it shook them up so much. But the other one that I'm super proud of, and people get to see a little bit of because I was allowed to present it at conferences, was the cyber analytic framework that I created for the agency. And the result of that was I went up after I was there for 3 months, I went up to the director's office and I said, hey, I've got bad news for you. There's nothing in the pipeline. You know, the pipeline's been everybody spun tactical during the previous director, and you don't really have a lot of program managers that understand cyber. You know, same problem in many other areas in the DoD. So your baby's ugly. I'll work it really hard, or you can just let me go if you're not willing to give me the gas, you know, and the juice to do it, and we'll separate, you know, on good terms. And I didn't realize that Regina was about to double down on, like, the budget for cyber, and this was a real surprise to her to hear. So she said, you have 4 weeks to put together the new way for the agency, and then you're briefing the Deputy Secretary of Defense, so it better be good. You know, the subtext is, I will fire you after that if it's not, but, you know.
Or kind of like this, I gave you some rope before, but here's even more.
Yeah, and here's a really big heavy weight to carry with you as you put the rope around you and keep walking out in that water. Yeah, as it gets deeper and deeper.
Let me ask you kind of a far off question. You know, there's this thing called the Valley of Death, which happens when technology gets invented scientifically, and then it just doesn't make it all the way to the stage where it's ready for, say, an early stage startup, even. And did you experience that Valley of Death in your own tech dev work? You know, among the projects that you were funding of people, I remember that when we did Code Review for Security, that was a DARPA project, and then mm-hmm. we used ATP funding to get it across the Valley of Death to Kleiner Perkins, but we needed that ATP funding. You know, it was like two years of more development to turn the science stuff into prototype stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting situation that DARPA's in, and, you know, I read more proposals than I think any other program manager has there, but that's also because Cyber Fast Track pulled in, well, you know, almost 600 of them alone, and then, you know, I had a good 50 or 100 from my other programs as well. And they're only allowed to fund things that are, you know, innovative. You can't do like an incremental improvement.
Exactly.
So I'd get a lot of proposals that would say things like, hey, we've got this, we've already done it, you know, we think we need to tweak it a little bit to make it really useful, and that's just, you know, that's out of bounds.
Yeah, so, you know, so there is a value of death.
I can't fund that.
You know, so where do you go in the government now to get over the value of death?
Well, the nice thing about the government, and what I tried to do with Cyber Fast Track, was to give people the initial funding to get a prototype such that they could control their own destiny. So if you know, maybe it was like 150K, maybe it was 200K, just to prove it out that this isn't just a wacky idea, here's an existence proof, because then the venture capital world or the commercial world or anybody else, they want to know, is it technical risk or is it turn the crank productizing risk? And the latter they can accept and they can actually evaluate, but the former, you know, they all stay away from Kleiner Perkins, wouldn't have touched it.
Oh, I know.
It's still the former.
It's still, even at a basic prototype, it's too early for most VCs.
Yeah. And, you know, luckily some of that panned out actually in CFT. People thought SIBRs would be the way to go, but what I learned in SIBRs and why they're just totally wired. Well, they're designed for something different. The Small Business Innovative Research grants, which Arbor Networks, I believe, you know,
we had some came out of.
Yeah, they are designed to try and create new defense industrial base contractors. There are three stages of the SIBR. The first stage is, here's some money, start getting used to our processes and procedures and how to do the billing and stuff with the government. Second stage, if you want that follow-on money, you now have to have the government controls and accounting systems in place.
Yeah.
And the third stage essentially is now you're acting as a traditional government contractor. And it's very important for, you know, the DoD to build up new lines of government contractors. But a lot of, you know, universities or small businesses, you know, yours included, probably went to that going, this is a great way to kickstart a small business and turn it into an external business without realizing they're cross-incentivized. There's a little bit of a perverse incentive structure there where Party A wants one thing and Party B wants the other.
Ours were through the National Science Foundation. And what happened at the NSF is the panels would switch out and you wouldn't cite somebody's favorite paper. So you did all the stuff you wanted to do, they would still not give you phase two or phase three or whatever. So we found out that funding from DARPA and the ATP in much bigger chunks, like the $5 million to $7 million range, was what we were looking at, not SBIRs.
Yeah, and I preferred to play in the 6-2, 6-3 funding realms primarily.
Yep.
For those folks that aren't familiar, it's the color of the money. 6-1 is fundamental research. It's a grant, largely goes to universities. 6-2 is applied, and then 6-3 is normally, not palatable for public consumption.
Yeah, we would call it red, blue, and purple money. So let's switch gears again. What was it like to go to Google from the government?
Well, let's see. It was easier for me to get approval in the DoD to talk publicly at events than it was at Google.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
I mean, that sounds more sensationalistic than it actually is. They're just a huge organization. They don't want everybody running around, especially with the group that I became deputy director of, which was ATAP, the Advanced Technology and Projects Group.
Based in Motorola, is that right?
Yeah, initially. So what happened is I called up folks and I said, well, I'm interested. And they said, yep, great. There's this new thing starting up in Google. Come on out. And then I get the offer and it's like Motorola. I'm like, what the heck? They had just acquired Motorola.
Yeah.
So I went over as a corporate vice president of engineering at Motorola.
I love it. Did you have to live in Chicago?
Oh, no. Out in Sunnyvale.
Well, at least California, there's that.
Right next to Google. And then when Google sold Motorola, my group wasn't on the table. Google was unwilling to part with that group and folded it back into Google.
Mm-hmm.
So
that was a pretty short stint, right? Like a year and a half, something like that?
It was 2 years, and by design. So I'm not running ATAP. It wasn't my baby to create. And,
right.
You know, Google has the ultimate say on this. But for all intents and purposes, what I liked about it was that it was very much modeled after DARPA.
Right.
And whereas DARPA is designed to create new tech that's strategic, that's going to feed back into the DoD ecosystem so that people, you know, don't end up painting themselves into corners. You know, I looked at ATAP as doing the same thing to feed back into the Google ecosystem, whereas Google X I equated more with like NSF or some other ones, which was, you know, interesting research, no real timeline, and, you know, good things will come of it, but we don't really know what.
Right.
Versus ATAP's DARPA sort of approach of, we need this. This is a great thing, and here's how it might fit into, you know, the Google ecosystem.
Yep.
And it's on a 2-year time frame. But a lot of folks don't realize the DARPA program managers are only there for a maximum of 4 years.
Yeah, and that got screwed up during the Tether time too.
Well, there were a lot of tricks that were being played where people would leave for a cleansing period of a few months and then just
Anoop
come back
did that,
in.
As, I think.
I like Anoop. I'm not gonna.
I do too. I think he's great, but I think
he's
one of those guys who spent a long time at DARPA.
Yeah, I mean, and those things are normally in place for a good reason. You know, the same reason that you like to have some of the directors cycle over more frequently. You have such control of discretionary taxpayer money in those positions. You don't want one person chasing a pet project that should have been put down, you know, years and years and years and millions and millions and millions of dollars, you know, later. Or, and you don't want people funding, you know, their buddies, you know, right, just because it's their buddies.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, when you get somebody really good like a Noob, you're kind of like, geez, I wish he could stay because
exactly,
he's actually making a difference.
Yeah, there's a real scientist here. Oh my. So, last question, last kind of topic. You're working on this project that's inspired by Underwriters Lab that you're calling the Cyber UL. What's the vision for that? And is there a relationship with the actual UL? And, you know, what kind of progress have you made?
So the correction is that it's inspired by Consumers Union,
okay,
and it's inspired by Consumers Report, Consumer Reports, and the scientific and quantifiable and comparative evaluation of products, so that to give consumers information and capability and tool, you know, a tool to be able to make informed decisions.
Yeah, because security is too invisible, so somehow make it more visible.
Oh, entirely. And there are numerous, you know, straightforward ways of doing it. There's measures of complexity. There's, you know, well-known horrible functions. There are compiler flags that you better damn well be using for the past decade that Microsoft's had in, like, /GS. And as we saw, some of the most popular antivirus, you know, vendors disabled those because it was just easier for them to debug on their side.
Right.
You know, but ultimately that puts the consumer at risk. So, you know, think about what, you know, Consumers Union does for their, you know, car reviews, and then put that over in software. The, you know, the Underwriters Laboratory aspect was something that way back at the loft, John Tan, who's one of the guys at the loft, he got inspired because I kept using the example of Consumer Reports, and I said, I really wish I knew how Consumer Reports, you know, started, you know, because they were so independent. You know, no ads, no anything else. I actually brought a lot of that into AtStake. AtStake, you know, wouldn't do partnerships. We wouldn't accept freebies. We wouldn't accept kickbacks for recommending somebody's product, which was entirely the norm for every other consultancy. I like that we're only interested in...
I remember ICSA and NCSA, which were completely pay-for-a-good review set up that way.
Or Cisco Security Consulting Group, which very well might have had great people on it, but how much you want to bet the recommendation is going to be a bunch of Cisco products.
Right.
You know, and you want that unbiased sort of aspect to it. So I asked Tan, I said, see what you can find out about consumers, you know, Consumer Reports. You know, there wasn't a Wikipedia at the time. You could surf the whole web in, you know, a day and a half, 2 days. We used to do it. and I used to, you know,
I used to
I
have Node 400, dude.
Yeah. And I used to, I had friends, I'm not saying whether I did it or not as well, but google.stanford.edu used to crash with just a few packets going after it. Those poor guys in their room.
That used to be Alta Vista was the best search engine back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And then Excite.
Yeah.
Remember those guys?
Oh, yeah, I do. And then Lycos and all the other ones. But yeah, Alta Vista was pretty good. But back to it. And what Tan came back with was Tan said, hey, check out Underwriters Laboratory. And this is the paper he wrote in 1998, I believe, on Towards a Cyber UL.
Mm-hmm.
And it was entirely focused on how the UL focused on locks and safes and vaults.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it in a very similar way to you know, how Consumer Reports does. And John Tan, which is his handle, is, you know, a tip of the hat to the, you know, the John Tan safe and vault manufacturing company. So no surprise his interest there.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the similarity was. You could have a vault rated TL-15 or TL-30, and it wasn't a certification. I'm not a big fan of certification just from the get-go. Be like, uh-huh, I'm just going to come up and certify stuff and willy-nilly. But I like the idea of comparative ratings. With, you know, they say TL-15, this vault can withstand drilling and manipulation for about 15 minutes. TL-30.
Yeah, but the funny thing about cyber is if you find a way to a vulnerability or an exploit in a certain amount of time, why wouldn't you just fix it?
so there's the challenge. So let's use this as a corollary, a car, right?
Yeah.
So you find a car and there's a recall. Yeah, because, you know, the rear passenger seatbelt doesn't latch correctly.
Yeah.
Well, that tells you about a specific problem, But that sort of Consumer Reports, you know, evaluation where you see that it's all a bunch of cold rivet joints and that the gaps between it imply really crude machining on the background and the bumper test, you know, you get an overall rating and just a few fixes of those things are not going to move.
Got it. So that's kind of what happened to Tesla stock this week, I guess. They got consumer reported.
I think that has more to do with they're not cash flow positive, and they're looking at the energy production facilities to turn cash flow positive in Q4.
Do you? The press was saying it was all about Consumer Reports' bad review.
Yeah, but that wouldn't make sense because it started to turn the other way a little bit before that. So, well, maybe there's leaky press.
Yep. Who knows? So what?
You see what I'm saying? So Microsoft has how many millions of lines of code? And if they come out with a patch that touches 20 lines of code, you know, and they fix, you know, an unbounded string copy, they fixed a particular instance, most likely. And they didn't fix the fact that that's, you know, something that they do in common coding practices. Now I'm picking on Microsoft. They've actually improved a lot.
They have improved
but,
a lot.
But, you know, that's what you want to do is you want that overall rating.
Yeah.
That's easy to do, quick to do. You don't have to prove an individual vulnerability, but you get a level of hygiene and you get that sort of safety feeling.
So,
how much effort did they put into it in the first place?
So can you tell us what progress you've made so far, or is that enough?
Lots, but you'll have to talk to our chief scientist about that.
Okay, well, maybe we will set that up. So I think Sarah's going to be a future victim.
That sounds good.
Cool. Last question, which has nothing to do with any of this. If you had to name your favorite piece of music from 2015, what would it
from
be?
From 2015?
Yeah. I know,
oh,
making it hard.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, favorite piece of music from 2015.
Okay, all right, skip the year constraint.
Yeah, I mean, my classics are any of the, you know, the Monster Zappa pieces.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Frank.
Good call.
Right, 'cause you could just listen to it so many times and find so many different components in it.
Those guys were amazing players.
Oh, dude, those are the best, you know, best players in the world. Actually, the drummer I used to play with at Berkeley, Joe Travers, is the drummer for Dweezil Zappa and is in charge of Frank Zappa's vault.
Wow.
The music vault. So
very cool. So name one piece so that we can put a URL to it and people can experience Zappa that haven't done so before.
Oh, Inca Roads. Absolutely. Frank Zappa, Inca Roads.
You got it. Perfect. Well, thanks. It's been fun.
Oh, man. Likewise. Take care.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2015 issue of IEEE S&P is devoted to the economics of cybersecurity. The issue features our interview with European cryptographer Bart Pernille. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.